You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to the 2020 census, the population of Americans aged 65 and older saw its largest ever 10-year numeric gain, an increase of 15.5 million people from 2010 to 2020. That group also had its fastest growth rate of any decade since the 1880s, largest ever percentage point increase relative to the rest of the population. If that trend is sounding familiar, you may have heard the term silver tsunami. The baby boom generation started turning 65 back in 2011. As a result, the demand for senior services has been steadily increasing. At the same time, there's a growing need for training and recruiting workers for senior living and other services for older adults. The national trade group Argentum, which works with companies that own and operate senior living communities, forecasts that by 2040, there will be 3 million job openings for senior living. A program that started at UW-Eau Claire is working to meet the need for workers in senior services, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is that you? Do you work or have you worked in some form of senior care or services? What led you into that line of work? What kind of training did you have? Did the pandemic impact your employment at all? And did you leave that line of work? And what questions do you have about getting into professional senior care of any kind? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug Olson is president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services. For more than two decades, he was with UW-Eau Claire's nationally recognized healthcare administration program and director of the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
And Shayana Vanale is also with us. Shayana is currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire while working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. She's a member of the Vision Center Advisory Council. Shay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Doug, take us back to the start of this healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire. What problem were you trying to solve?
Well, the healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire has been around since 1976 and was a very solid program, one of the few in the state for sure and in the country. We had kind of a big shift around 2000. The godfather of the program, Gene Decker, did a great job running it for many years. But then we took it to a different level and we formed what you mentioned before, this thing called CHASE, the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. And that program was really all about bridging providers and the university together to kind of work on really making it a solid program for students aspiring to be looking for a career in aging services leadership, and that's really been our focus.
And then here we are in 2023, Doug. What are some of the biggest challenges in bringing people into this line of work?
Well, we actually had done a lot of things at Eau Claire that we're kind of using to move forward with this new Vision Center. One of the things that we kind of really emphasized was the importance of that field experience administrative training program that allows people to go out after their time on the campus with solid curriculum and then moving to a place where they can learn the practice and the trade of leading organizations that are taking care of people's parents and grandparents. And that significant shift was we also mandated that it would be a paid experience so we could get the very best talent to do the work and learn the practice of senior living administration and do exceptional things around providing the best quality and services possible for those individuals living or needing to live in a setting or requiring services too, because the spectrum has changed a ton over the years, Rob.
And Shay, let's bring you in. What made you want to study to prepare for a job in senior living and care?
Honestly, it is not what I came into college looking for. I was a bio pre-med major, and I feel like a lot of times in high school, you kind of get two options. If you want to be in healthcare and you want to help people, you can be a doctor or a nurse. So I was like, okay, I like kids. I'm going to be a pediatrician. And then by second semester, I was kind of feeling the weight of the student loans were not going away, and I still had 8 to 12 more years of school before I could start paying those down. So I was sitting in my chemistry class the first week, and this kid next to me was like, I'm an HCAD, and I'm taking this class for fun. And I'm like, okay, well, I hate chemistry, so you're weird for taking this class for fun, because that is not me. But tell me more about HCAD. And so he told me a little bit more, and I loved the fact that they said it was a heart for caring and a head for business. So I went back to my dorm room, joined HCAD 101, and within 2 weeks I had switched my major and also joined the student org on campus and tracked Doug down and begged him to give me an internship.
HCAD, Healthcare Administration. Shay, what is it? You're also doing some work as a caregiver now. What would you say to people who, you know, maybe that line of work isn't on their radar about what a fulfilling line of work it could be?
I'd say just give it a shot. I definitely had the same fears as many people do have that senior living homes are kind of smelly and scary and dark. And just getting inside of them, whether it's visiting a family or a friend or even volunteering, whatever you can do to get inside and realize they aren't the stigma that follows them, I think that really turns people's heads around and makes them double think about what senior living can offer them.
We're talking about a program that came out of UW-Eau Claire that tries to bring professionals into senior care to work in various kinds of senior care facilities. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of Vision Center, and Shay Van Ael, who is going through the program at UW-Eau Claire, working in a center herself. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in senior care yourself at any level? Love to hear your experiences, how you got into it, the challenges. Do you or your family member count on people doing these jobs? Are there enough of them out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Doug, we see a lot of lines of work saying, hey, we're not finding the staffing we need. We have a shortage of workers. Is that particularly true in 2023 for various kinds of senior care work right now?
Yeah, that trend in all industries right now is impacting senior living as much, if not more. I think COVID really amped up the challenges in senior living, and I think there are many heroes that rose to the occasion, but it certainly has been one of those that we've really worked hard, not only through Eau Claire, but through the Vision Center, to start changing the narrative about these jobs really fulfill purpose, provide meaning, have a variety of possibilities with them. Our particular focus, Rob, is all about finding good leaders, because good leaders, stable leaders, talented leaders help that culture and that workforce tremendously. And that's one of the areas that we see when you talked about the number of people that are not going to be in with positions that are unfulfilled. We estimate probably 250,000 of those jobs are in the leadership roles. So it's one of those things that at the core of what we're trying to do is not just replicate, but try to expand the landscape of senior living leadership programs across the country.
Shay, can you talk about the kind of things you're getting in your classes that are you hopefully preparing you to be a leader, maybe an administrator in senior care?
So one of the great things about the UW-Eau Claire program is that during your final year, what that would be on campus, you are put into a long-term care facility where you are working as the assistant administrator. So for my senior year, that is what I'm doing now. And some of the things that I've learned in classes don't compare to what you see in the facilities. You can learn about the statistics and the F tags and everything all day long, but until you're in the community, talking with the residents, talking with the staff, feeling them for what they think needs to improve, the classes don't mean much once you can get that hands-on experience.
We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care, a program started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Ael, who's currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire and working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. And Doug Olson is with us, formerly director of UW-Eau Claire's Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence, currently president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit focused on leadership development for aging services, taking some lessons from Eau Claire and sharing them around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests, either about studying to join the senior care field or addressing the workforce gap? Are you one of the baby boomers who's hoping people go into this line of work and provide some of the services you're looking for, or maybe for a family member of yours? If you work in this industry, love to hear your perspective as well. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care and a program that started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Isle, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire, and Doug Olson, president and CEO of Vision Center. That's a nonprofit that works on these issues, bringing lessons from Wisconsin to the rest of the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug, can you talk about the gaps you see out there in the kind of academic training, the kind of work you've done in Eau Claire and now around the country that you're trying to fill here?
Really focused around coordinating partnerships between providers and universities, providing a new narrative about the field, and also providing resources. We started this journey about 5 years ago with a sabbatical I did, bringing together all these stakeholders across the various sectors of the field. And once we got started with that, what turned out to be a project turned into a momentum, and now is an initiative that is really focused around trying to bring universities to a place where they're graduating more students that are either at an undergraduate, graduate, or even a mid-career from university programs. So we started working with about 20 universities. We moved that up to about 40, and now once we launched last fall, it's been about 60. And we're working with them in a variety of ways to help them accelerate the development and growth of these programs. These are not programs, like Shay said, you know, these are not programs that someone comes into a university always and is really, it's not front and center like accounting or biology or chemistry or nursing. And so we've really tried to raise the bar around what we're doing with universities across the country. And we have done some things around assessing what early career paths people are looking for from a student perspective. We're doing some innovative stuff around field experiences. That is really what Shay talked about is the secret sauce of these programs. That's really where the hands-on learning and problem solving and really understanding how you're working with people and for people really happen. I always get a kick out of Shay saying she's learned more in 3 months in her field experience than she did on campus. But it's so critically important. And you know, we've really worked hard. We do a symposium every year. We have webinars. We have other things that are really kind of advancing the field. And you know, when you mention it grew out of Eau Claire, there's a lot of best practices that came from Eau Claire. But there's a lot of things we're learning as we work with other universities across the country. We're working with universities in the West, the Midwest, the East, the South, and each of them come from different kind of perspectives. Some will come out of a hospitality school, some come out of a business school, some come out of a health science school. So collectively, we're kind of all learning together, and we're making great progress.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
I just have to tell you that I had a very, very large family. I had a lot of children of my own, but I always had wanted to be a nurse. And, of course, then it was a little too late to go to college or school to be a nurse. But I could be a nursing assistant, and I went to tech school, and I was a nursing assistant at our county nursing home for a long, long time. And I'm telling you, I loved the people that I cared for. And the thing is, it reminded me of when my dad was in a nursing home up in up north. Anyhow, I went to see him one day, and the door was closed, and knocked on the door, and a gal said, "Oh, you can't come in now. We're doing a dressing." I said, "I'm coming in. I'm a nursing assistant. I've seen it all." I had not seen it all. My father was I could see his bones in his back because obviously they had not transferred him or taken care of him and turned him and such things. And then I called the state and I told them, and they they told me that they were only following doctor's orders. And I'm telling you, I never saw anything like that before. But even after I retired from the, from our county nursing home here, I took care of so many people. I was, you know, with them when they died in their homes. And
Nancy, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks for sharing your experience. Now, Shay, I'm hearing from Nancy the value of caring if you're going into this line of work. And really, it sounds like based on her experience with her dad, she wanted to put all of herself into the care she was giving to people. How important is that, being willing to have that, I guess, that emotional vested interest in the work you're doing?
It's huge. The long-term care industry is hard. It is not easy. It's not even fun some days. And it is something that if you do not have the passion for this field, you're not going to succeed. And that's why these paid internships are so big, because it gives you the opportunity to see if this is what you want to do before you jump in, because the residents and the staff don't deserve someone who doesn't care. And that is something that my current preceptor is huge on, is these grow-as-you-go programs where she wants the CNAs to become TMAs and RNs and LPNs and directors of nursing. She wants to encourage the passion with everyone and show them that they can be more than what they are today. If they have the passion, they can do anything in this field.
Nancy, thanks for sharing your experience. We're talking about an effort to bring more people into senior care at the highest levels and at all points. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of the group Vision Center, and Shay Van Isle is at UW-Eau Claire studying to do this. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Doug, you and Shay have both said something along the lines of, you know, nobody goes into college thinking they're going to go into this line of work. You know, I know some fields were reaching into high school saying, hey, put this on your radar as a potential career. Is that maybe a next step?
Yeah, we are already. First of all, I want to, Nancy, I'm sorry about that one situation with your loved one. I also worked as a nursing assistant, and I would echo what Shay said. It takes passion. It's hard work. They're never paid enough for what they do, and I think society really values. During COVID, we saw how much family members and community members valued, how much those staff members really contributed to the quality of life for their person. You know, one of the things that we are doing, Rob, is we are reaching into high schools and colleges to get the perspective from these new emerging leaders so that we're really talking about the profession of senior living leadership in a way that kind of resonates with, kind of away from the stigmas and the stereotypes of this is a profession that every day you make a difference for a loved one or a staff member. And you have a tremendous impact. I often say to people that the real test of a country is, you know, how they treat those that are underserved or underprivileged or frail. I think that is really the moral compass that our country really should be thinking about. And I think you mentioned before, I mean, that silver tsunami is right there at the front door. Many people would say, why did you start this, Doug? I would say we should have started it 5 years ago. One of the things that is clear across the country is that we are definitely needing to make sure that we have people, because you talked about there'll be more people over 80 by the year 2032 than that are under 18. This is one of those kind of demographics in our country that's maturing that is really going to have to pay attention to how we do what we do. And we're going to have to do it differently. And that's why there's a lot of creative new solutions around how do we really take care of people's loved ones.
And Shay, given the time of year right now, somebody might actually be in their car getting ready to be dropped off on their campus for their freshman year. Talk directly to them, if you will, to put these careers in senior care on their radar, maybe if it's something they hadn't even thought of before.
I think it's really just about keeping your eyes open. And one of my biggest things, I was terrified to change my major and terrified to look elsewhere because I had felt like I failed. And that was not the case. If it is, I failed upwards, so I'm okay with that. But I would say just get involved. Take 101 classes that maybe aren't up your alley, but they could turn into something so much more. Be a part of the student organizations. You're not a nerd if you are. They are fun, and they help you make friends, and it helps you find where you're supposed to be, and you will find it, and you will fall in where you're supposed to be, and it is very rewarding once you get there.
And Doug, let's speak directly to another audience now. Maybe somebody's out there listening who works at or maybe even runs some kind of senior care facility, and they're not involved with Vision Center yet. Speak to them and how they can get involved.
Well, what I would tell them is that, one, they can contact me directly at dolson@visioncenter.org. And there's also, the train has left the station. There's lots of room on the train yet. And if people want to get involved, there's a variety of ways to do that, whether that's being involved and connecting with the university themselves, whether it means finding a placement for a student that wants to do an internship in this field. We really, really understand the value proposition of having someone new to the field with lots of different perspectives that really want to make a difference as a valuable asset for any senior living organization, that is, whether it's assisted living, senior housing, skilled nursing, home and community-based services. There's a broad spectrum, and we're going to need all of them. And what I will also tell, you know, the listeners is that it's also a very, very rewarding career that is got a lot of growth opportunities, and it's one of those things that I don't think you will ever look back, just like Shay said earlier.
We'll leave it there. Doug and Shay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to Doug Olson, President and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services, and Shay Van Eyl, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire. We talked to them about Eau Claire's successful program, training the next generation of senior care professionals. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Get ready to can and pickle and preserve your favorite summer and fall produce. Our guest has lots of advice. You could join in with your questions or tell us your favorite things to can for the winter. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, consumer spending on live entertainment has returned to pre-pandemic levels. A lot of it has to do with two words. Those are Taylor and Swift. We'll talk to an American culture and music historian about how live music bounced back. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The pandemic made 2020 a cruel summer for live entertainment as musicians canceled tours and left a blank space on concert calendars across the country. Slowly, the live music industry has found a way to shake it off, and the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis reports that household spending on live entertainment returned to pre-pandemic levels earlier this year. There was no bad blood for fans who were eager to get out and see their favorite artists again, led by the gold rush that is Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, which is projected to surpass $1 billion next year as it goes international. Call it what you want, but the tour has surpassed even her wildest dreams, helping the live music industry begin again and re-spark the love story between fans and their favorite acts they know all too well. We're learning more about what the resurgence of concert spending and the popularity of the Eras Tour says about the importance of live music in U.S. popular culture and the economy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been getting out to more concerts again lately? What do you like about seeing live music? What value do you think live shows have in the age of music streaming? What do you think of the success Taylor Swift is having? If you're a musician other than Taylor Swift, love to hear from you. What are you seeing when you go out on tour or just to play at the local club? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Waxman is the L.C. Irwin Sweeney Professor of Music and Professor of American Studies at Smith College in Massachusetts. He's the author of the book Live Music in America, A History from Jenny Lind to Beyonce. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Really glad to be here.
Let's start with what I think is a pretty atypical example, the incredible success of this Taylor Swift show. What is driving the massive economic success of this tour?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors, and obviously a huge part of it is Taylor Swift herself. She's such a phenomenon as a pop star, and I think she brings together a lot of different audiences. I think she cuts across age groups in a way that's really quite significant, that not every pop star is able to do. I think she also cuts across like taste categories, you know, because she's got her like country following from back when she used to do that. She's got her pop following. She's got her folk following. Like she herself has been so multidimensional. And so her reach is just like, there's not much else to compare it to among contemporary pop artists. But she's also just so, she's such a great marketer of herself. And that includes marketing her live music tours. It used to be the case 2 decades ago or so that live music was often treated in a pretty secondary way by artists and their agents and record companies. But of course, with the bottom having fallen out of the recorded music industry a couple decades ago, live music mattered more and more and more. And I think now it also matters in a whole different way to audiences. I think the pandemic really made a lot of people like me feel what it was like to lose live music. I was so tripped out. I couldn't even believe, like, I couldn't go to see a show. Like, what is life like when you can't see a show? It was surreal in not a good way. And we're seeing that resurgence now in a way that's really profound. People are recognizing that having that face-to-face contact with an artist, but also with a crowd, right? With an audience, like these things matter so much and matter, I think, with renewed force in the wake of the pandemic. And so I think it's those factors all converging right now onto Swift's tour.
Now, most musicians are not Taylor Swift. We saw a wave of some musicians more in mid-tier, like Santa Gold, Lorde, and some others, canceling tours or saying why they weren't doing a tour supporting their new album. For them, after the pandemic anyway, they might have just broken even on a tour. What are the economics and the interest look like for that non-superstar tier touring act?
I think it's a really important question. And I think one of the things that we're seeing in this revival of the live music industry now is that I think there's maybe a greater gap between the live music haves and the live music have-nots. And I don't think that's an entirely new trend. I think that's been building for at least a decade or even more than that. And there's longer term issues at work there that we can talk about if we have time, like consolidation in the live music industry, I think has been a big player in that. But I think Santa Gold, Lorde, and others who've spoken out, like they've spoken out about things that are really very, in some cases, very routine sorts of concerns that have had really tangible impact. Like we've been in an inflationary environment for the last two, three years. And that has impact on live music touring, just like it has impact in every other aspect of our lives. When artists don't have the profit margins of someone like Taylor Swift and costs are mounting up, it becomes harder and harder to put a show on. But I think what we heard from someone like Santi Gold actually was at a conference last year where she spoke about her challenges in touring and why she chose to kind of call off her tour last year. And she was really also stressing the psychological cost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those things that's just a variable that you can't control. Some artists, some people, right? We see this in our lives. Some people have bounced back from the pandemic and they're just back to normal life and everything is like, great, just a little interruption. And other folks are a lot more affected by what has happened over the last 2-3 years and are still coming out of it. It makes sense that we would see that among artists, that some artists felt like having to deal with the pressure of being on tour, being on stage, meeting the demands of their audiences, it was more than they could bear after having been in relative isolation for so long. And all the more so because some of the things that they used to be able to take for granted a little bit about putting a tour on, they can no longer take for granted. The labor power wasn't there the same way. You know, it's hard to get workers in the live music industry, just like it is in the fast food industry. All of these things are factors that some artists are being more affected by than others.
Talking to Steve Waxman from Smith College in Massachusetts, author of the book Live Music in America, looking at the current state of live music in America, the massively successful big money Taylor Swift tour, and what's going on at all levels of the industry. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to go see live music? Did you used to, but you don't anymore? What led to that change? Are you going to see Taylor Swift, or is there another big artist that you're willing to put down big bucks for? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, you mentioned the haves and have-nots among musicians. How about fans? I know as ticket prices go up, people are paying hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars for some of these high-profile shows. Concerns that, you know, that kid who might have gone to see that rock and roll show for $5 is out of luck now.
Yeah, I think that is another really big factor. I mean, thankfully, and I always feel like this is something that is important to point out, not every show costs that much, right? Like you can still go to a bar or a club locally, see a few bands, maybe pay $10, maybe not pay a cover charge at all. If you're old enough, you can buy a couple drinks. That kind of thing is still very much reality. I think it's also the case that some of the venues that host those kinds of shows are the ones that are struggling more in the current economy than the big, you know, stadium shows and things like that. But I think it's become much more the case that, like, for the biggest tours, they're sort of predicated on the fact that people have a lot of disposable income, and that's going to absolutely keep some folks from being able to enjoy what those tours have to offer in a way that is very different from what the live music concert economy was a few decades ago. I think, you know, back in the rock era of the 60s and 70s, concert tour ticket prices were a whole different ballgame. And it was because it was assumed that the main audience was young people who didn't have as much money to spend. So it was assumed that if you charged more, I mean, at the time, it was like $10 was a high ticket price, right? It's kind of hard to even imagine nowadays. But it was assumed that if you went beyond that threshold, people wouldn't buy. And I think part of what we've seen, why that's changed, is because I think rock, as it has aged as a medium, has meant that, like, aging audiences, which there used to be the assumption that if you got to a certain age, you no longer listen to the stuff you listened to when you were younger. We know that's not true anymore. So people who used to be into a band like The Police when they were 12 years old or 20 years old are still going to be into that band when they're 60. And they're willing to pay $250 or $500 for a ticket to a show like that that they could never have afforded when they were 15 years old. And so I think that's been a big driver of change. Parents are taking their kids to shows in a way that was definitely not true when I was a kid. So I think there's been some generational shifts that have contributed to why the market has changed so much in that direction.
Steve, you mentioned consolidation in the live music industry, and I think we can't tell the story of modern live music without talking about the Ticketmaster and Live Nation stories. What do you see as the biggest impact?
Well, the biggest impact is that at the highest level in the industry, it's a very small number of major corporate players who are negotiating for market position among themselves with very little room for competition. And I think that has, you know, its obvious dimensions, which is like Live Nation, Ticketmaster, a few other companies like AEG just have a near monopoly on the industry. But I also think it has a big impact with regard to artists. And I think artists have spoken out about this, that artists often feel pressured to work with these companies because there really aren't good alternatives. Some artists make the most of that. Some artists use it to their advantage. And one of the things that I think Taylor Swift has done so well in the rollout of her tour, like we know, like there was so much publicity about how she basically broke Ticketmaster, you know, to put it crudely. But she used that in such a savvy way. She made it seem like it was her versus Ticketmaster. I don't actually think that's a very accurate way of rendering the story, because Taylor Swift has cooperated very closely with Ticketmaster and other major corporate players in the live music industry for years, just as she's cooperated with various record companies she's dealt with. And yet she's managed to somehow strike this tone where sometimes she's fighting for artist rights, sometimes she's fighting for her own independence, even when she's also reaping the benefit of those relationships. I think other artists could learn something from her about her ability to kind of use those relationships to her advantage. But I think more artists feel trapped by those situations. More artists feel like they don't necessarily have as much free range of choice as they'd like to have if they want to really take full advantage of the career opportunities that lay before them. And I think that has everything to do with the way that industry has become consolidated since basically since the mid-1990s.
We're talking to Steve Waxman, professor of music and American studies at Smith College, about a resurgence of live music led by Taylor Swift's Eras Tour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a music fan or a musician yourself, how much did you miss live music during the early months of the pandemic? Are you glad to see concert spending coming back? Are you part of that story? Have you been going out to see lots of live music, whether it's the corner bar or the big super show? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
I said, oh my, what a marvelous tune. It was the best night, never would forget how we moved. The whole place was dressed to
the night. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's Taylor Swift, whose Eras Tour is setting new records and having an economic impact on a par with the Super Bowl if they played it again and again in different cities. She's been the face and voice of the live music industry bouncing back from the pandemic, but her experience doesn't necessarily mean good news for all live performers. We're picking up the conversation with Steve Waxman, professor of music and American studies at Smith College in Massachusetts, with us today looking at the cultural significance of live music. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Fran is with us in Viroqua. Fran, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call both as a parent who just recently took her daughter to see Ed Sheeran. It was her very first concert, so that was something new for both of us. But I'm also calling as a singer-songwriter. I know that many of us, you know, we're not really big name, but those of us who are, you know, we're trying to make a living through concerts, we went online and we're able to support ourselves that way. And many of the larger name in singer-songwriters, many artists are supported through the Patreon app. And that's an app where fans can support their artists through a monthly pledge. So that has, I think, grown in resurgence. And also, I wanted to comment about like concerts in the park, local music, and how that happened during the pandemic so that, you know, communities could still experience live music. And that has just really flourished since the pandemic. So I just wanted to make those comments. Thank you.
Fran, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I think everything that Fran just said is right on. You know, what I've been really intrigued to kind of keep an eye on, and it's hard to get a read across the board, is like, yeah, I think she's right. Things like Patreon, like just generally streaming performances, became so much more crucial as a way for artists to support themselves and for audiences to feel connected to music they love. And so coming out of the pandemic, how much is that stuff still mattering? I think it is still mattering a lot. I think it's kind of become an extension of the way that artists have used things like Twitter and Instagram in order to create those bonds with their fans. And I think, personally, I have to say, I never felt like watching a live stream had the same pleasure for me as an audience member as being at a show, because the thing that I couldn't reproduce was being in a room with folks. So I think it's those tools are absolutely crucial, and especially crucial from a perspective of where do you get your revenue from? But it's now, I think it's like a supplement that artists can take advantage of along with everything else. And that's great. But also just reviving some sense that music is something that can happen, like, you know, that outdoors was a place we could do things more safely. The town I live in, Northampton, Massachusetts, during the pandemic for the first time ever, or as we were just coming out of the pandemic in the early phase, started closing off this one central street downtown to traffic and having music there 3 or 4 days a week. We'd never done this before. And once we started doing it, it was like, why haven't we been doing this forever? Like, it's the best use of public space you could imagine. And thankfully, we have continued to do it now that we're in much less risk than we were, just because it's such a wonderful way to make downtown feel like a more lively, inclusive space. So absolutely, that, you know, I think we often find ourselves in those situations where we're like, well, at least that one good thing came out of the pandemic. That is definitely one good thing that came out of the pandemic, I think, in a lot of local communities.
Fran, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve, I've focused a lot on the economics of live music. Can you talk a little more about the cultural value? What do we gain when we get together with other people and then watch other people play music for us?
Yeah, I mean, what do we gain? You know, there's so many dimensions to that. I think music itself is just so enriching. And I think having that sense that, to me, I think being part of an audience really matters a ton. You know, you can listen to music at home. You can listen to the same music at home that you can hear in a concert. If it was just a matter of hearing that music, you don't need to go to the concert, right? We go to the concert because we want to have that sense of being present for something. And that presence is partly being present for an artist who we really admire. But I think so much of it comes from the social part. Comes, you know, you may or may not have a conversation with somebody in the room. You may or may not do more than make eye contact with the people who are around you. But when you go to a show, however big it is, you're there and you've made the same choice to be there as all the other people who are there. And if it's a big show like a Taylor Swift show, chances are almost everyone else who's there is a fan. And you might connect with those fans in other areas, right? Like you can, again, you could connect with other fans on social media sites and various other areas where you can kind of have that sense of this is the thing that you share with other people. But there's something so powerful about seeing that manifested in person, live in front of you. And especially, I think, it has one way of impacting us when it's thousands upon thousands of people. It has another way of impacting us when it's dozens of people, right? Like, I go to see like a show of experimental jazz or something like that, and I'm one of maybe 50 people in the room, and I still have that sense of connection. Like, we've all made a decision to be there on that night because we care about this music. I think that makes a huge difference, and it's why live music matters so much in general over time, and why it matters in a very particular way after a time when we were not able to connect with people in quite that way for longer than any of us would have hoped.
And now, Steve, a lot of times we go see a show, it's to see a known quantity. I'll say I used to be more adventurous. And, you know, if I knew the cover charge was $5, I'd walk into a bar and see what they were, sight unseen, knowing nothing. Can you talk about the value of just wandering in and checking out something that may surprise us?
I mean, for me personally, that's like my favorite thing to do. I often actually prefer to see a show where I don't know the artist that much. And then if I really dig it, I'll like go explore their music further afterwards. I think there's something that happens when you encounter music for the first time live. You have that sense of how it's made. You have that sense of what the singer's really bringing to it, where it's not just like you're hearing their voice, but like you're really kind of seeing the artist just like pour themselves into it, if that's what they're doing. Like if they really are an artist who's compelling and who moves you. I think it's a great way of musical discovery. I think, you know, even like live streaming, like to get out of the purely live, but like the live stream can be another great way to do that. You still have that sense of like the artist being a physical presence. I really value that experience a ton. And I wish more people would look at it that way, as not just like, here's a chance to hear all those songs I've been listening to at home already for the last 2 years, but here's an opportunity for me to experience something that is completely unique and that I may not otherwise have ever encountered.
And just briefly, Steve, if I could ask a personal question, did you try to get tickets to Taylor Swift?
I did not. And that's not any diss on Taylor Swift. I will admit, like my own concert going, I do a lot of it. But I mostly go to small shows. I mostly go to local shows, not necessarily always bands I know, although sometimes it's friends. That was the last show I went was friends of mine. But I really like to support small local venues. I feel like they are the ones that really need the support. People are going to go to see Taylor Swift, whether or not I'm there or not. So I like to have an experience that feels a little more personal to me.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been really nice talking with you.
That's Steve Waxman, the L.C. Irwin Sweeney Professor of Music and a Professor of American Studies at Smith College in Massachusetts, author of the book Live Music in America. He was with us today to look at the present and past cultural significance of live music as the Taylor Swift Eras Tour helped bring concert spending back up to pre-pandemic levels. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.